Okay, let's get into this. We're doing a deep dive today into something pretty fundamental about self-knowledge. It's a place where a lot of people, especially people who are, really analytical and quick thinking, they just hit this wall. We're talking about embodied awareness. More specifically, we're looking at what happens when the kind of standard entry point, the cornerstone of so much somatic work, that one question, where do you feel that in your body? What happens when it just doesn't work, when it doesn't create clarity, it just creates more frustration. And for you, the learner, this is a really critical conflict. I mean, you see all these techniques that promise this quick, intuitive access to your inner world, but what if the method itself is the problem? What if the instruction manual you were given is for someone else's operating system?
That's a perfect way to put it. That gap is
Yeah.
it's crucial. And the sources we're looking at today really highlight that this often affects neurodivergent individuals. So I'm talking about people with ADHD, autism, or alexithymia.
Alexithymia, that's
Yeah.
the inability to identify your own emotions, right?
Exactly. So for these folks, that whole pathway,
Yeah.
the line from an emotion to a physical sensation and then to a location your brain can name, like my stomach is in knots, that whole communication channel can be scrambled or
Yeah.
just blocked.
So you ask them where they feel anxiety, and the brain just kind of returns an error message.
Precisely.
So our mission today is to really unpack how one person, a self-directed learner, solved this. We're going to dissect this three-part, I'd call it a plain language system that was built to bypass those broken pathways and find a real personalized sense of home inside yourself. Let's start with that first roadblock, that question. For Rachel, the person who developed the system, being asked, where do you feel it, didn't get her to my chest or my gut. It just led to, well,
One of those
confusion.
big general answers, I feel everything.
Right, everything, or the complete opposite, I feel nothing at all. And just think about that for a second. You're trying to do the work. A guide asks you to use this standard map of the body. And for Rachel, the source material says it was like being asked to describe the sound of purple. That's such a great analogy.
It's perfect, isn't it? The theory is sound, but the translation step, locating an abstract feeling in your, muscles or skeleton.
Yeah.
It just fails to compute for her nervous system.
And this is where we have to be really careful. Because the common assumption is, oh, they must be dissociated or, they're just unwilling to
The
engage.
psychological block.
Right. But what the data shows is that this is often a technical problem, a physiological one. The nervous system is reporting the information. It's like it's sending a massive data file, but your conscious mind doesn't have the right software to open it.
So the info is there. It's just in the language you can't read. You can't translate that raw bioelectric data into, say, my Nitis type.
Not on demand, anyway. The processing mechanism that assigns it to that standard anatomical map is it's offline. Okay, so if the map you're given is broken, you have to draw a new one. This is where Rachel's approach gets really interesting. She realized the problem wasn't the sensation itself, it was the language. When the where question failed, she invented a new one, a completely different metric. She started asking, what do your cells feel like?
Which is such a revolutionary shift.
It totally is,
Yeah.
because it just bypasses the whole location problem. It activates a totally different part of your brain, the part that deals with pure sensory input, color, texture. So instead of, I feel stress in my back, she'd say things like,
My cells feel green and electric.
yes, green and electric, or something even more specific, like, it feels kind of sticky in my shins.
And what's so fascinating is how functional that invented language is. You can
Right.
actually break it down. This cellular consciousness, as we're calling it, it's this brilliant alternative organizing principle.
This whole system.
It is. It has three parts. You've got the global feeling, which is the green and electric field across the whole body, then the regional concentrate.
Sticky in the shins.
Exactly. And then the base unit of sensation, which is the cell itself. She didn't need to know anatomical terms. She just needed to know the texture of the electrical current flowing through her body.
But wait, wouldn't inventing a whole new language be harder? I mean, isn't that just shifting the cognitive load somewhere else?
That is absolutely the right question. And the answer is, in the bypass, she was engaging her nervous system on its own terms. And this connects to some really established neuroscience, like synesthetic remapping.
Synesthesia, like when people see sounds as colors.
Sort of. Think about it from pain research. There are these clinics in Italy that treat chronic pain or even phantom limb pain by asking the patient to give the pain a color, a shape, a texture.
And then what?
Then they ask them to change it. To imagine changing the color from angry red to a cool blue, or making the texture smoother.
Wow. So the implication is, The nervous system doesn't really care if the input is real in the way we think of it.
Precisely. The system doesn't distinguish between a, quote, real sensation and an imagined one as much as we think. By using color and texture, Rachel was essentially building a new input pathway, a back door. It allowed her to reconnect with her body's true state without having to go through that faulty anatomical map.
Okay, so now she has a working language. She can tune in and say, my cells are green and electric. But that leads straight to the next huge challenge, especially for people with fast minds.
The drive to make meaning?
Instantly. The speed of that transition is just, it's unbelievable. A sensation happens, your shoulders get a little tight, and immediately the story kicks in. I'm stressed. I'm failing. I should be better than this.
And that cycle, sensation to story to conclusion to judgment, It's a shame spiral that can happen in less than a second.
And it leads to the wrong solution every time.
Which is why the second pillar of her system is so radical. It's the suspension of meaning making.
Yeah.
You have to clearly separate the two things. There's the state, which is just the direct experience. What is happening? Shoulders tight, breath shallow, cells green.
No judgment attached, just the data.
Just the data. And then there's the story, which is the interpretation. I'm anxious, something's wrong. The practice is to stay with the state, completely neutral, without jumping to the story. Because if you rush to meaning, you're working with insufficient data. You'll get the wrong answer.
That feels so counterintuitive, though. We're trained to see a problem and solve it immediately. Just sitting with it feels like inaction.
It does. But the example she gives is so powerful. She talks about observing the simple state, my shoulders are tight, for 2 weeks.
Not 2 minutes, not 2 hours, 2 weeks.
2 full weeks of just neutral observation, just noticing shoulders are tight and letting that be the end of the sentence. She wasn't trying to fix it. She was trying to learn from it.
And that discipline, that sustained observation, it breaks the automatic link between the feeling and the shame.
And after 2 weeks, what happened? A totally different story emerged, a more accurate one. It wasn't chronic stress causing the tightness. It was her desk setup. It was a posture problem.
Which requires a completely different solution, a physical one, not an emotional one.
Exactly. The goal is to unlearn that drive to create a single narrative too quickly. The right story emerges from the data if you just give it time.
So once you can stay with the state and hold off on the story, you add the final layer.
Nervous system literacy. And the goal here is to name your current physiological state, not just emotionally, but in terms of bioelectric and physiologic safety.
This is where things like polyvagal theory come in.
Right. It's about learning to recognize your own internal modes. There's ventral vagal, that's your safe, connected, calm state. There's sympathetic, which is the activated fight or flight mode.
Yeah.
And then dorsal vagal, the freeze, shut down, collapse state.
Well, understanding the definitions is one thing, but the sources are clear. Applying this to yourself is incredibly hard.
It's a huge time commitment.
It took her months of observation to accurately map her own sensations to those categories.
Oh.
Because everyone's system is unique, right?
Completely. Your sympathetic fight mode might look like yelling. Mine might be talking really, really fast. Someone else's could be, you know, aggressively cleaning the kitchen at 2 a.m.
And if you just label that being productive, you miss the point.
You miss the signal. You don't realize your body is in fight mode and needs a safety intervention, not a to-do list. You have to learn your nervous system, not just the textbook definition of a nervous system.
And underpinning all of this is a core attitude, a psychological shift. Once you can identify a state, say, okay, I'm in sympathetic activation, the next thought has to be,
nothing wrong with that. Just aware of it.
The awareness is the intervention. You stop trying to immediately fix it, which just adds another layer of stress, and you just allow it to be under the light of your own attention.
And this whole system, the cellular consciousness, the state versus story discipline, the nervous system literacy, it works so well for people who are, as she puts it, intellectually fast and vast.
And very oriented to meaning.
Exactly. It lets you use that powerful mind, not to bully your body, but to become its translator, to create your own plain language. It's what she calls embodied metacognition.
It's about reestablishing the relationship.
That's it. It's about achieving internal coherence, is how you bring yourself home.
What really stands out to me is this lesson in adaptive learning. When the standard language doesn't work for you, when it feels like jargon, the job isn't to force yourself into that box. The job is to invent a plain language that your system gets instantly. And that's the real takeaway for you listening. If the standard methods have failed, you don't give up on embodiment. You find your path. For Rachel, it was green, electric cells. For you, it might be temperature or weight or something we don't even have a name for yet.
It reframes the whole challenge as an opportunity for curiosity. It reminds me of the poet Rilke. He said that maybe the feelings we can't name aren't our weaknesses, but something helpless that wants our love.
Just waiting for us to approach them with curiosity.
With curiosity and with the permission to be weird. The permission to invent.
So what if the reason this kind of work hasn't clicked for you isn't because you're broken, but just because you've been using someone else's map? What if the next great step in your journey is building your own? And with that, we have to ask you right now, what do your cells feel like?